okay, now that I know that no one's judging me after our meditation, right? It's true confession time. So I want to start by telling you about a gift I was born with. No need to be jealous, though. And some of you might have the same gift. It's the gift of feeling dead inside. I used to see it as a curse, the curse of depression. And because depression ran in my family, I think I just accepted it on some level for a very long time. And I was raised Catholic, but wasn't active in the church by choice because it wasn't a welcoming experience for me. I tried therapy, which was helpful, but certainly no cure. But I became really interested in the mind and how it works and why we do the things we do. But I wanted to study it as a scientist. I was certain that spirituality would have nothing at all to do with it, with this revelation I imagined having. But after getting a PhD in psychology, I was still struggling. In fact, my depression peaked a few years later with the birth of my children. I had postpartum depression with both of them. And this is what depression felt like to me when I was at my lowest point. So this is actually the first paragraph from my book. Depression has a taste. Its bitterness will not leave your mouth, no matter how many times you try to swallow it down. Depression has a smell. Its rancidness saturates every breath you inhale. Depression has a sound. Its piercing shriek is so deafening that lips are moving all around you, but you can't make out a word. Depression has a look. Its searing glare is reflected in eyes that only send daggers your way. Depression has a feel. Its bone-chilling frost is like an anesthesia that never wears off. Yeah, so there's that. But it was in the midst of this all-time low that I finally reached my point of surrender, and I made a cry for help in my mind. And I remember exactly what I said to myself. I said, all right, well, if there's a higher power, which I don't think there is, then come and save me, which you probably won't. And you're going to have to do all the work because I'm in no position to get myself to you. You can see that I'm balled up on the couch right now. And that actually worked. Not instantly, but very gradually over time. So I started opening myself up in a new way. I taught yoga for a while. I ran a business as an energy healer. And then I ran into, or was introduced into to the book A Course in Miracles by a colleague. And I was never the same after that. The book had me at hello. And I do feel that the course helped me heal my depression permanently. And it really came down to me confusing internal and external. I thought that my external self was what I presented to the world through the roles I played, and I thought my internal self, my private thoughts of self-hatred, were the real me. And now I know that my private thoughts of self-hatred are just as external to me as everything else that I think I am. When I think with the ego, the fear-soaked part of my mind. So now I'm to the point on a good day where I can think of my depression as a gift, because I was actually seeing the ego very clearly. And through seeing it clearly, I could make a firm decision to see that it had nothing to offer me and I could let it go. And what I went through inspired me to write a book about self-deception. And I'm going to share all of the top 10 lies with you in some detail. But first, the spoiler alert that there's really just one lie in need of correction, and that's the idea that it's possible to be separate from each other and separate from our source. And that error has trickled down to all other lies. So here's the list as I see it. And my list was inspired by David Letterman's top 10 list. I thought, what if the ego had to reveal what it was really up to? Wouldn't that be funny? So number 10, lie number 10, nothing's more important than being right. And of course you always are. The game the ego plays is, if I can convince myself that you are wrong, I can cover up my hidden belief that I'm the one who's actually wrong. And in psychology, Anna Freud called this reaction formation, where the person who digs in their heels the deepest, you are wrong, is actually the most afraid that they are the one who's actually wrong. So this awareness can help you respond compassionately in a situation where you may otherwise be tempted to defend your position. And the Course asks us, do you prefer to be right or happy? An exercise in mental stretching would be to ask yourself two questions. Who have I locked up in the penitentiary of the eternally wrong? And what judge do I consult to confirm my sentencing? Of course, if you're locking anyone up in your mind, you're doing it with the ego, who wants you to build that wall between yourself and others stronger and higher every day. Line number 9, there's not enough of anything to go around, so take your share by any means possible. And the ego loves to take you down the rabbit hole of scarcity. And the way it works is either you have something or I do, but we can't have it at the same time. But what if our belief in lack came first, and then we started seeing that belief projected outward in the world and in our bodies? Ken Wapnick, a Course philosopher, wrote in his book, Form Versus Content, "The body was made as an instrument of scarcity. If I do not fill my lungs with oxygen, my body with food and water, and my psychological body with love and attention, something terrible will surely happen." And the way out of the scarcity trap is to draw from spirit's knowledge of abundance as our identity. So challenge yourself to set an intention one day at a time. For today and today only, I'm willing to believe that I could never run out of anything that matters. So my list of things I have enough of today are lip balm, arugula, friends, and love. Line number 8, chaos is business as usual, so just get used to it. And the Course clarifies the problem at hand. You look on chaos and proclaim it as yourself. And often we do let chaos define us, but we could view it as a choice. Chaos is our unconscious acceptance that everything must change, blocking our awareness that nothing real ever could change. Our perfect peace is unalterable. And the practice is to pay close attention to the slightest irritation at the chaos around you, because beneath it lies seething resentment and anger, like molten lava ready to erupt. So I've asked myself, if minor irritations are a sign of a larger problem, does that mean I'm almost constantly angry? Well, yes, when I'm following the ego. I think I'm angry at XYZ outside of me, but I'm really angry that I think I pulled off the impossible, separating from my source of love. Line number 7, there is someone out there who can finally complete you, so never stop searching. And if we keep looking, the ego confidently tells us we are all but guaranteed to find the feeling of completion we long for in another. After all, it's a great big world filled with endless possibilities. But the secret mantra of the ego, according to the Course, is seek and do not find. And ego-driven relationships are very primitive. I've looked at my husband like he was the president, meaning there's no better person to carry out my agenda. And I've looked at my husband like he was a president I didn't vote for. Like there was no person more in the way of me completing my agenda. But we can evolve all of our relationships by allowing spirit to repurpose them. And it will result in a shift away from elevating or condemning the other person, as you understand that completion and wholeness is something that both parties already bring to the table. Line number 6, you must find a way to be truly unique or better than others, because you are. And the ego tries to convince us that if we don't continually strive to be unique and superior, our identity will weaken until we cease to exist as an individual at all. But spirit clarifies that only the fictional separate self that we created would be released. And the thing about chasing the victory is that the victory is not really that sweet. This is because it's isolating by nature. Our most special victories can't be shared. The Course says specialness can never share, for it depends on goals that you alone can reach. So, for example, my long-term goal of finally becoming a doctor made me happy for all of about 1 month, not the lifetime that I had imagined. And this is because our individual goals always feel a bit hollow, and joint goals are much more fulfilling. Line number 5, you must attack first and often or risk being defeated. And all forms of attack, from physical to verbal to just thinking about it, are vehicles for the ego's agenda to reinforce the idea of separation as a fixed state of being above all else. Applying spirit's knowledge, we can come to understand that attacking or being attacked wounds us equally. That's because there's actually only one of us here appearing as many, which means that all attack is self-attack. The ego wants us to focus intensely on our enemies, and this prevents us from figuring out that it's actually our unconscious guilt over separating from our source, that never really happened, which is behind attack in every form. As the Course reminds us, you are trying to escape a bitter war from which you have escaped. The war is gone. And the practice of parting ways with attack thoughts is to replace them with thoughts of innocence. So start with something easy. So for me, I can see complete and total innocence in my cat, Zane Grey. And this is easy since my cat can do no wrong in my kingdom. And then just keep going, eventually including those who you feel have wronged you. So I see complete and total innocence in the school bus driver. And this has been difficult for me since my daughter was injured on the bus and I didn't feel like the driver handled it well. And this is related to line number 4. The person who can hold a grudge the longest wins. So hang on tight. And the ego will cheer us on until we're the last grudge standing, the ultimate prize. And it's the mantra of only the weak let things go. And if we do, against all odds, attempt to release a grudge under the ego's guidance, it will be of little value, whether we do so because we're better than anyone who wronged us, or we demand an apology with a dramatic ultimatum, or we hide a lasting resentment behind momentary kindness. In each case, we've still fulfilled the ego's goal of seeing ourselves as separate and better. Even when we muster up enough compassion to understand where the other character in our grudge story might be coming from, although that's an improvement, what would really cut to the quick is to acknowledge that a part of us, the false part, unknowingly consented to the story with the goal of self-punishment. And wow, was it effective. Spirit can help us unlearn this destructive style of forgiveness with a reminder of oneness, which means that all forgiveness is self-forgiveness. As the Course teaches, my grievances show me what is not there. Any grievance against another is symbolic of our totally unjustified grievance against our source, that it somehow wronged us when we forgot about it from the perspective of the ego's dream world of hate. We can repurpose the world from the ego's prison to spirit's forgiveness classroom, where we are ready and willing to look at our faulty perceptions about everything. So instead of active fault-finding, our interest shifts to recovering faultlessness. Line number 3, reacting out of fear comes naturally, so just stick with the program. And operating in fear is our default setting until we choose to follow spirit, the teacher of love, instead. We are either loving or fearful all of the time. Only the ego believes it's possible and necessary to mix love with a healthy dose of fear for our own protection. But love built on a foundation of fear is doomed to fail. Fear mixed with love is our experience only because we set it up that way in the dream we share. It's the cruelest form of self-punishment imaginable, and we are just imagining it, a continuous reenactment of believing we discarded love and then must fight fearfully to get it back. And the Course says, produced by fear, the ego reproduces fear. And this reminds me of the computer science concept of GIGO, garbage in, garbage out, which simply states that faulty input yields faulty output. So our faulty input was accepting this fear-inducing idea that separation from each other and our source was possible and was what we wanted above all else, and all output following that decision has been infected with fear and is therefore faulty. And we can learn not to trust it. Line number 2, love is a sign of weakness and can really mess with your head. Just avoid it at all costs. The ego's goal is to use fear to block love in all forms from our awareness and then send us on a desperate, never-ending search for it. But the ego doesn't want us to remember that we are love itself. If we did, the ego would cease to exist instantaneously. And the Course encourages the mantra, love is my heritage, and with it, joy. What we are called to do is get in the flow of love. Think of it like handing out Halloween candy. We give it freely and equally to all the children who come to our door, right? Even if we prefer some costumes over others. Some costumes are adorable and some are fearful. Fear is just a very popular, overused costume that we can choose to wear or choose to shed. We certainly don't need to ask someone else to take theirs off to prove their love underneath. We know that on some level, and we can act accordingly. Since there's only one of us here, appearing as many, imagine that you are the one holding the candy bucket and the one getting the goodies. So you can give out candy unconditionally to all the other versions of yourself. And in doing so, you alone would transform fear to love on a grander scale than you could even imagine. And yes, I'm saying that candy equals love. Have you tried marshmallow peeps? I mean, oh my God. Okay. And line number one, you can't count on anyone but yourself. And by the way, you're a huge disappointment. The ego is out to persecute you personally. Although it's actually not personal, because it reserves the same fate for all of us, to take the idea of separation to the extreme where we each experience the horror of not feeling connected to a single thing. And the ego won't rest until it gets you to that place of suffering and solitary confinement. But the ego's days are numbered. It's the only part of us that can die because it was never really a part of us. To remember this truth, we need only give the teacher of misery the pink slip, and the new hire, the teacher of joy, can ask, "Can we laugh about it yet?" And I've realized that if I can't make something fun, I just don't want to do it. And my 20-year-old self wanted to be a singer, an actress, or a stand-up comedian. So I'm attempting to combine all those things that I love to do. So I'm going to finish this talk with a mashup I did of my favorite book, A Course in Miracles, with my favorite movie, The Sound of Music. So I'm using the soundtrack to tell the story of the healing journey that we all share. It really is universal, and we can find comfort and laughter in that. And please sing along. And oh, you added pictures to my slides. Someone did that. Lovely. Okay, let's wait one second.